Chapter 20. All the next day, Silke is on edge, distracted. She calls a patient by the wrong name, fumbles giving medication. Her eyes go constantly to the door, waiting for a head to pop round and announce that the ambulance is going out. It doesn't happen, and she returns to the hut, disappointed. Her melancholic state was meant to improve today. Now she has released some of the burden and with the prospect of something new to focus on. She wants an instant fix to a problem she can't articulate. To make matters worse, Hannah has cornered her again, saying that her supply is being cut off and that Silke must procure the drugs for her again. So it must have been the trusty thug who died who was supplying Hannah all this time. And despite her conversation with Yelena, when Silke looks around at the women in the hut, she still doesn't think she can face that moment when their faces change to horror, pity, fear, maybe even hatred. The following morning, she has to force herself to concentrate, get on with the job at hand. When the call comes, "Ambulance going out," Silke misses it. "Silke, you're needed," Raisa calls out. Silke looks up at Raisa, to the door, and sees the man waiting for someone to acknowledge him. Grabbing her coat, hat, scarf, and gloves, Silke follows him outside into the whirling snow and perpetual darkness of the Arctic winter.
"Hurry up! People are dying out here while you take your time putting your bloody layers on," the driver yells, revving the engine impatiently.
The man Silke followed opens the back door of the modified truck, indicating for her to get in. The ambulance takes off before the doors are closed, sending her flying. The passenger in the front seat leans round, smiling as Silke tries to shove herself up against the side, bracing herself for more violent driving.
"Haven't seen you before. What's your name?"
With her hands planted firmly on the floor, her legs spread apart for support, Silke checks him out. His friendly grin reveals a few large, crooked teeth. He's wiry and olive-skinned, with heavy eyebrows framing bright eyes.
"I'm Silke. This is my first time out." "Hey, Pavel, it's her first time," the gruff driver says.
He is bulkier and broader than Pavel.
"From what I saw of it, it'll probably be her last as well. Look at the size of her." "She may prove you wrong there, Kirill Grigorovich," says Pavel.
The two men cackle away. Kirill winds down his window as he nears the closed front gates, which are lit up by the searchlights of the compound. Sticking his head out the window, he screams at the sentry as he speeds towards him.
"Open the fucking gates, you moron! Can't you see we're in a hurry?"
The gates are barely open when the ambulance races through, and a torrent of abuse from the sentry follows. Crunching the gears, Kirill winds up his window and shakes the snow off his hat.
"Excuse me," Silke says loudly, ensuring she is heard over the revving engine. "Find out what she wants," Kirill says.
Pavel leans back over the seat, staring at Silke.
"Pavel, is it? What can you tell me about where we're going? What kind of accident is it?" "Yes, I'm Pavel Sergeyevich. We'll find out when we get there."
"But surely you know if there is more than one patient?" Kirill cackles away, his big shoulders shaking up and down in his coarse pea coat. They are prisoners, she thinks. Trustees with a good job, driving back and forth with cigarette breaks in between.
"That you can be sure of, honey. When any part of a mine collapses, there will be more than one casualty."
"So you do know what happened. Why couldn't you just say so?" "Well, well, what do we have here, Pavel? A nurse with attitude. Listen, Princessa, you just do what you do when we get to the scene and we'll transport them."
Silke looks around her in the back of the ambulance. Two stretchers are stacked against the side of the truck and two containers slide around the floor. One comes to rest against Silke's leg. Silke edges the top off the container to examine the contents. An assortment of instruments bang against each other. Rolls of bandages, bottles of medication. Silke lifts each one, identifying exactly what she has to work with. Dragging the other container over, she finds the equipment for hanging a drip and two bottles of saline solution. The road is pockmarked. The ambulance swerves round boulders, bounces against snow piled at the side of the road, visible in the headlights.
"Time for action, honey. We're here."
The ambulance screeches to a halt, throwing Silke against the front seat. Before she can steady herself, the back doors are thrown open, hands reach in and grab the stretchers, A hand is held out for her to take, and she is helped down. Silke notices the numbers roughly sewn on their jackets. She takes a moment to have a quick glance around. At first, she can see nothing in the dusk and sleet. Then she begins to make out figures, men moving about aimlessly, some screaming orders. Silke, Pavel, and Kirill make their way to the opening of the mine, towards the ladder-like structure with the wheel on top. A guard strides over.
An upper tunnel is caving in. We're not sure when it's going to be safe to go down.
The wheel above them creaks to a stop as a lift cage full of soot-blackened men arrives at the top. The men spill out.
There are still injured men down there, one of them says, holding his hat in his hand. We have to go and get them, Silke yells. Who's this? The supervisor asks Pavel. It's the nurse they sent with us, Pavel answers. Not much to her, the supervisor responds, looking Silke up and down.
Silke rolls her eyes. Let me go in and see if I can help, she says.
Didn't you hear me, girl? The tunnel is still collapsing. Do you have a desire to die?
No. Silke raises her chin. She advances towards the now empty elevator cage, looking back at the men.
If you want to go in, go, but I'm not coming with you, the supervisor says.
I can't go alone. I don't know how to operate this or where to get off.
I'll come, Pavel says, without conviction. I'll take you to the level, the miner with the hat in his hand says.
His teeth are chattering. Cold or shock, Silke wonders. Wrapping her scarf over her mouth and nose, she steps into the cage. Pavel follows, loading the equipment in too. The miner clears his throat, then pushes a lever, and the lift jolts into action, lowering slowly into dusty gloom. Silke checks the lamp Pavel handed her as they set off. They go down and down and down. Silke tries to keep her breathing steady. The lift stops at a tunnel entrance. Silke clears her throat. She unlatches and pushes aside the lift cage door.
It's a bit of a walk, the miner says, indicating he will stay where he is. Just keep to the left.
Silke and Pavel do as he says.
We're here to help you,
she begins to yell out. Debris enters her lungs and she coughs.
Call out so we know where you are.
Here, over here,
she eventually hears from somewhere in front of her. The voice is weak, scared.
I'm coming. Hold on, keep talking. I'm here. Keep walking.
By the light of her lamp, Silke sees a hand waving at her. Scanning the area, she sees three other men, not moving. She hurries to the man who had been calling out.
I'm Silke Klein. She kneels and gently lays a hand on his shoulder. Are you trapped?
My legs. I can't move them.
Silke examines the man, seeing that his lower legs are pinned by a large chunk of rock. She gently pushes him down flat and checks the pulse in his neck as Pavel arrives beside her, opening the container.
What's your name? Silke asks the injured man.
Mikhail Alexandrovich.
Your legs are under a boulder, but I think we can move it, as it's not that big. You have a nasty cut on your head, which we can wrap up to stop the bleeding. Mikhail Alexandrovich, I need to go and see to the other men. Do you know how many of you were in here when the collapse began?
Four of us. The others had gone for a break. We were loading the last wagon.
I can see three others, she says, waving her lamp around.
I'm not going anywhere, he says. Check on the others. I was calling their names, but none of them answered.
Cautiously, Silke steps over the rubble covering the floor of the mine tunnel. On reaching the first man, she checks for a pulse, finds one. Pulling back an eyelid, she holds her lamp above his eyes. One reacts. Running the lamp over his body, she sees he is not pinned down, just unconscious.
Pavel Sergeyevich, go back and convince that miner to come and help us. Take this one first. He's unconscious, but you can move him.
Be right back,
she hears as Pavel heads back to the lift. Silke finds a second man. Immediately she can see he's trapped under fallen rock. She finds no pulse. The third man groans as she holds her lamp above his face.
My name is Silke Klein. I'm here to help. Can you tell me where you're hurt?
The man groans again.
It's all right. I'm going to have a look and see if I can find your injuries.
She quickly identifies a badly broken arm
twisted in an unnatural position. A large rock is pressed up against his side. Gently, Silka pushes on the man's chest, from side to side, then further down his abdomen. He cries out in pain. With difficulty, she pulls at his clothing, undoing his coat so she can see. Pulling his shirt and undergarments from his trousers causes him immense pain. Silka sees the crush injury below his ribcage. She hears the crunch of footsteps in the tunnel, and Pavel is back with the miner, each carrying a stretcher. She scrambles over to the unconscious man. "Load him up and get him out of here," she says. "And then there's another who can be taken out, but you need to go carefully. He's badly injured and in a lot of pain. Get both of them out of here and I will tend to him in the ambulance." As they take care of those two men, Silka goes back to the first man she spoke to, the one who is trapped. "I'm sorry. One of your friends is dead." "The others?" he asks. "They're alive and we're moving them out. Now we have to think about how to move this rock off your legs." She stands, looking around in the gloom, feeling helpless. "Don't go, please." "I'm not going anywhere. I can't move it, though. It's way too heavy for me and I don't want to roll it off. I think it needs to be lifted off, so it doesn't do any more damage. Hang in there, Mikhail Alexandrovich. I'll get something for your pain also." She hunts for the supplies that Pavel had placed in the tunnel and finds the pain relief. She returns to Mikhail. "Mikhail Alexandrovich, I'm going to give you an injection to help with the pain," she says. "And then, when the men come back, we're going to gently lift the rock from your legs and load you onto a stretcher. The ambulance is outside the mine and we'll take you to the hospital." Mikhail painfully raises a hand and brushes it against Silka's face. She smiles reassuringly at him. She takes scissors from the container and cuts through his coat and shirt, exposing his upper arm. She injects him slowly and watches as he relaxes, his pain diminishing. Silka sits in the gloomy, quiet tunnel, waiting, coughing regularly. Eventually, Pavel and the miner come back. "All right," she says. "You need to slide your hands under each end of the rock, and when you have a good hold, lift it off cleanly. Do not roll it or drop it on him." She holds her lamp up for them. She holds her breath. The men lift the rock, wobbling slightly, and drop it down to the side, panting with exertion. Silka looks at Mikhail's legs. Bone protrudes through the skin of his right shin. Pavel and the miner place Mikhail on the stretcher, and they all hurry back down the long tunnel, to the lift, and up and out of the mine. The dead man will have to be removed when it is safer. With Mikhail loaded into the ambulance along with the other two injured men, there is no room in the back for Silka. Kirill leers at her. "You'll just have to ride up front with us. Get in." Squashed between Kirill and Pavel, Silka has to constantly remove Kirill's big hairy hand, which is attempting to creep up her thigh. She winces at the cries that come from the injured men in the back as they are bounced around, Kirill showing no compassion or care for their injuries. She offers up words of comfort, telling them they are nearly there, nearly at the hospital, where doctors and nurses will take care of them. The drive cannot end soon enough for Silka. Chapter 21. Silka reaches over and opens the passenger door before Pavel can. He finds himself pushed out of the ambulance, Silka right behind him. Two orderlies approach and open the back doors. "This one, take this one first," she points to Mikhail. "Then bring the stretcher back to get the other one." She indicates the unconscious man lying on the floor. "Give me a hand," Pavel calls out to Kirill as he pulls the other stretcher free from the ambulance. Silka runs after the first patient, unbuttoning and flinging off her coat as she enters the ward. Yelena, another doctor, and several nurses appear. "This one, Mikhail Alexandrovich, small head wound, both legs crushed by a large rock."
"I thought you said it was a small rock," Mikhail whispers through clenched teeth.
"I've got him," Yelena says. Two nurses tend to Mikhail, assisting. "Over here, put him on this bed," the other doctor calls out to Pavel and Kirill. "There's one more coming, unconscious but with a strong pulse, obvious head wound." "Thanks, Silka, we've got it," Yelena says. The unconscious patient is brought in and placed on a bed. Kirill leaves immediately, and Pavel wanders over to Silka. You did great work. Stupid and dangerous work.
Thanks. You too. I wasted too much time being angry with Kirill Grigorovich when I should have been helping the patients.
Kirill thinks he was born to rule.
Bad driver, bad attitude.
You better learn to get along with him, or he can make your life hard.
This again, thinks Silke, but she can't stifle a laugh. He is far from the most intimidating figure she has met. Pavel looks puzzled.
Let's just say I've seen worse, Silke says.
She looks around at the efforts being made to comfort and treat these three men injured just doing their job, a job with no proper safety measures.
She has seen injuries like this too many times.
The prisoners are here for their productivity as part of a quota, and they are expendable and replaceable.
But thanks for the warning, Pavel. I'll keep my distance from him.
Silke, can you give me a hand over here?
Pavel watches as Silke goes over to Mikhail, cleaning and rebandaging his head wound as Yelena continues the examination of his lower legs. Silke glances occasionally at the doctor, reading her expression as serious. Yelena says quietly to the nurse assisting her,
"Find me an operating room. We need to get him there straight away."
"What's going on? How bad is it?"
Mikhail gasps, his hand reaching out for Silke, grabbing her forearm, panic rising as he tries to lift his head to see his legs.
"I'm sorry," Yelena says gently. "I can't save your right leg. Your left is not as bad, and we should be able to keep it."
"What do you mean? Keep one and not the other, is that what you're saying?"
"Yes, we need to amputate your right leg below the knee. It is too badly crushed."
"No, no, you can't chop off my leg, I won't let you."
"If I don't, you'll die," Yelena says, keeping her voice steady. "The leg is dead. There is no blood flow into the lower part. If we don't amputate it, it will poison you and you will die. Do you understand?"
"But how will I... Silke Klein, don't let them chop off my leg, please,"
Mikhail pleads. Removing his grip from her arm, Silke holds his hand and brings her face close to his.
"Mikhail, if the doctor says she has to amputate your leg, then she has to. We will help you deal with this, help you recover. I'm sorry I could not do more."
"The leg was crushed on impact, Silke. There's nothing more you could have done," Yelena says. "I'm going to go and get ready. Silke, will you prepare the patient and I'll see you in the operating room." That evening, Silke doesn't go to the mess for dinner. Exhausted, she drops onto her bed and is instantly asleep. Men and women in white coats waltz around her, laughing. Some hold amputated limbs, tossing them to each other. Small children dressed in blue and white pajamas wander aimlessly between them, their hands outstretched. What do they want? Food? Attention? Love? A door opens. Sun streams in. A man enters, a rainbow halo surrounding him. He is dressed in a suit of immaculate white, doctor's coat unbuttoned, a stethoscope around his neck. He holds his arms out. The adults lower their heads in respect. The children run towards him, excited.
"Papa! Papa!" they cry out.
Silke wakes from her nightmare, but the memory that it awakens is just as horrifying. Auschwitz-Birkenau, 1943.
"Papa! Papa!" they cry out.
Boys and girls run to the man who has stepped from his car. He is smiling warmly at them, his hands extended and full of candy. To the children, he is a beloved father. Some call him uncle. Silke has heard the stories. Every adult at Auschwitz-Birkenau has heard the stories of what becomes of the children when they leave here, in his car. Silke watches from a distance, examining the slightly built man with not a hair out of place. His dark green tunic, without a crease or wrinkle, partially covers the white coat that indicates his rank of doctor. His clean-shaven face, his brilliant white teeth revealed by his big smile, his gleaming eyes, his SS cap tilted to one side. The Angel of Death. That is what they call him. Twice, prior to being sent to Block 25 and given a layer of protection, she'd had to parade in front of him.
She had barely dared to sneak a look at him, whistling a tune as he flicked his hand to the left or the right. Both times, she had escaped selection. The children clamber around him. "Pick me! Pick me!" they squeal. Four girls are tapped on the head and handed candy, and they climb into the car with him. The other children go back to playing. Silke bows her head in silent prayer for the four souls being driven away. Silke cries out, sitting bolt upright in bed, shaking, terror etched on her face. The women in the hut are all looking at her, some from their beds, several others standing around the stove. "Are you all right?" Olga asks with concern. Silke looks from one to the next, scanning the faces only partly visible in moonlight. Pulling herself together, she drops her legs over the side of the bed. "Yes, I'm fine, just a bad dream." "This whole place is a bad dream," Elena says. They are being kind, Silke knows. It is not the first time she has woken them by screaming. Anastasia has told her too that sometimes she whimpers and sometimes she hisses, like she is furious with somebody. Silke shuffles to the stove. A comforting arm, Elena's, is wrapped around her shoulders as she extends her hands to feel the warmth. She glances towards Hannah's bed, can't see whether she is awake and watching or not. Only she would know what the nightmares are really about. But she is probably more blissfully asleep than any of them, having collected her goods from Silke's pocket when the women all came in. There are layers of pain within Silke. She misses Josie and Natia too. All winter it has been impossible to see them. Natia must have grown so much, may even be walking by now. "You need to remember the happy times to dream about," Olga says from her bed. "That's what I do. Every night before I fall asleep, I remember my childhood on the beach in Sochi. It was a happy time." As Silke closes her eyes for the second time that evening, she decides she will try and remember a happy time in her life. It is not for a shortage of them. Quite the opposite. Her life, up until the day she was loaded onto a cattle train, had been blissfully happy. And perhaps for this reason, remembering has been too painful for her. But she will try again. Bardejov, Czechoslovakia, 1941.
"Move over, Papa. It's my birthday. I want to drive the car."
The day is cool, with the sun shining. A spring day, full of promise. Silke has put on her hat and scarf, placed her father's driving goggles on top of her head, determined to drive, even if only to the end of the street. Papa has lowered the soft-top roof on his Pride and Joy, a two-door roadster with brown leather seats and a horn that can be heard miles away.
"You don't know how to drive a car. Don't be silly, Silke," her father replies.
"I can. I bet I can. Mama, tell him I can drive the car." "Let her drive the car," her mother says lovingly.
"Now you're being silly. You always spoil the child," her father says, although they all know it is he who dotes on Silke, on both his girls.
"I'm not a child," Silke protests.
"You are, my dieta. That will never change."
"I'm 15. I'm now a woman," Silke boasts. "Look, here's Uncle Moshe and he has his camera. Over here, Uncle, I want my photo taken driving the car."
Uncle Moshe greets Silke, her mother and sister, with kisses on each cheek. A manly handshake and pat on the shoulder for her father.
"Are you going to let her drive?" Uncle Moshe asks.
"Have you ever been able to tell her anything? None of us have. Silke wants to rule the world and she probably will. Set up your camera."
Silke wraps her arms around her father's neck, standing on tiptoes to reach. "Thank you, Papa. Now, everyone get in the car." While Uncle Moshe sets up his camera on its stand, Silke sets about placing the members of her family where she wants them for the photo. Her father is permitted to sit in the front alongside her. Her mother and sister are in the back. With her hands confidently resting on the steering wheel, she poses. With a bang and a flash, the camera captures the moment.
"Where are the keys? I'll take you all for a drive."
"I'll make a deal with you," Silke's father says. I promise to give you driving lessons, but not today. Today is your birthday and we will have a lovely day, then celebrate at dinner. For now, we change seats.
Reluctantly, Silke concedes defeat, one of the few times in her short life she has, and, pouting, moves to the front passenger seat. Her scarf is flapping in the wind as she is driven through her hometown of Bardejov. Silke, in Vorkuta, finally falls back to sleep.
Chapter 22.
He made it through!
The words greet Silke as she enters the ward.
Mikhail Alexandrovich, where is he?
Bed one. We thought you might like to have him as close to the nurse's station as possible. You'll be able to write your notes and still see him.
I'll go and say hello.
Mikhail is sleeping. Silke looks at him for several moments, her eyes wandering down the bed to where she knows only one leg remains, hidden under blankets. She was present when his right leg was amputated. She touches his forehead, swathed in fresh bandages. Her training kicks in, and she picks up his file, scanning it for information on how he fared overnight. Nothing concerning jumps out at her. When she returns to the desk area, Raisa discusses the other patients and they share out the workload. Washing, changing dressings, administering medication. There are two new women on the ward who had a fight the previous night, inflicting nasty injuries on each other. Raisa and Silke agree to nurse one each to avoid getting caught in the middle of the dispute. Silke has barely begun attending to her patient when the words,
"Ambulance going out!"
are shouted.
"Go, I'll see to your patient," Lyuba calls out.
Outside, the ambulance is waiting.
"Do you want to ride up front?" Pavel asks.
"Yes," Silke says as she takes hold of the ambulance door.
"After you. Kirill Grigorovich can play with your leg today."
Reluctantly, Pavel climbs into the ambulance, pushing up against Kirill.
"What the hell are you doing?" Kirill demands.
Silke climbs into the cab, slamming the door shut.
"Let's go."
With a screeching of gears, the ambulance drives off.
"If we're going to be working together, can we try to get along?" Silke says, leaning over Pavel and staring at Kirill.
He changes gear, refuses to reply.
"Do we know what we're going to today?" Silke asks.
"A crane has collapsed and the driver is trapped inside," Pavel says.
"Only one casualty?"
"I think so, but you never know. Sometimes we've gone to an accident like this and found that the bloody thing came down and landed on 10 others," Pavel answers.
"Who is rescuing him?"
"Depends," Kirill throws out.
"Depends on what?" Silke asks.
"Has anybody ever told you you ask too many bloody questions?"
"Plenty of people, probably everyone who's ever met me."
The truck bounces over a boulder and Silke winces as her shoulder slams into the window.
"So you're not going to shut up then, is that what you're saying?"
"I'm not going to shut up, Kirill Grigorovich, so you better get used to it. Do you want to answer my question or should Pavel?"
"Well,"
Pavel begins to explain.
"Shut it. I'll tell Silke I have to know everything, Klein. It depends how dangerous the rescue is. If it's risky, then the supervisors will make the prisoners do it. If not, then the guards will want to make themselves heroes."
"Thank you," Silke says.
"We'll know as soon as we arrive how dangerous it is, then. I know you don't like talking to me, Kirill Grigorovich, but it does help if I have even just a little information." "Yeah, well, clearly knowing everything didn't stop you being sent here."
Silke chortles. "I never said I knew everything. I just like to know what I'm getting into." When they reach the site, there is nothing they can do straight away. Senior guards and supervisors appear from time to time to yell as prisoners try to untangle the mess that was once the long arm of the crane, now wrapped around the driver's box. There is no glory in this rescue. For the next 2 hours, Silke, Pavel and Kirill stand in the cold, stamping their feet, smacking their hands, returning to the ambulance to escape the wind. Several times, Silke climbs up the mangled metal frame of the collapsed crane to wriggle part way into the cabin to check for signs of life in the driver. Each time she notes his pulse getting weaker, the flow of blood from his head wound no longer gushing, the bandage she has put around the wound soaked in blood. After her last trip, Silke returns to the ambulance to tell Kirill to go back to the hospital. On the drive back, Silke sees the first bloom of spring flowers pushing their way through the frost on the ground. The wind whips them around, and still their stalks bounce back, staying rooted to the frozen earth. Silke has nearly served one third of her sentence. It is unbearable to contemplate how much longer there is to go. Instead, looking at the flowers, she dreams of the light and warmth that soon will come, and with them, time to see Josie and Natia again. When she gets back to the ward, Silke is told Mikhail is awake and has been asking for her. "How are you feeling?" she asks him, smiling, reassuring. "Is it gone, my leg? But I can feel it still, the pain is there." "I'll get you something for the pain, but yes, Mikhail Alexandrovich, the doctor had to amputate your right leg, but she has done a marvellous job repairing your left leg, and with time it will heal."
"And I'll be able to walk. How? How, Silke Klein, how can I live with only one leg?"
"I'm told they can make you a really good lower leg that you will learn to walk on."
"Really? You believe someone is going to waste money on making a prisoner a leg?"
He is getting angry. His voice is raised. "I'm not going to lie to you, Mikhail Alexandrovich. I don't know if you will be given a different job or whether they will send you home. You won't be able to work in the mines." "Is that supposed to make me feel better? That I might now be sent back to Moscow, to no home, no family, the one-legged man, to beg on the streets?"
"I don't know, Mikhail Alexandrovich. Let me get you something for the pain," Silke repeats. She turns away, not wanting Mikhail to see how their conversation has upset her.
Yelena has been watching her and follows her into the dispensary, shutting the door behind her.
"Silke, are you all right?"
"Yes, I'm fine."
"No, you're not," Yelena says gently. "But that's all right. You know how quickly things can turn bad here. You've seen it before."
"Yes, but
did I make a mistake putting you on the ambulance run?"
Silke stops looking at the bottle of medication in her hand, turning to face Yelena.
"No, no, not at all, that's not it."
"Then what is it? Do you know how long I'm to stay here?"
"I'm not told information like that."
15 years. 15 years, it feels impossibly long. "And then, after that, I don't even remember what life is like outside of a place like this."
"I don't know what to say."
"Tell me I will leave here," she says pleadingly to Yelena, "that I have the chance to live a life like other young women, that I will have friends that don't disappear from my life, that I might find that love exists for me too, that I might have a child of my own. Can you tell me that?"
"What I can tell you," Yelena says calmly, "is that I will do all I can to make that come true."
Silke nods gratefully, looking back up at the shelf, seeking another bottle.
"Promise me you will talk to me if you feel any worse than you do now," Yelena says.
"My father always told me I was the strongest person he ever knew, you know that," Silke says, still not looking at Yelena.
"That's a lot to live up to."
"Yes, it is. But I have always wanted to live up to the expectations of my father. Not disappoint him. Stay strong no matter what. I don't even know if he's still alive."
She shrugs.
"It's unlikely."
"A curse and a blessing from your father. I was very young when my father died. I would give anything to have your memories."
"I'm sorry."
"There's a patient out there waiting for you. Come on. I'll have a look at him while you give him the medication."
"What will happen to him now that he only has one leg?"
"We'll get him stable, then move him to a larger city hospital where they can rehabilitate him and hopefully get him a good replacement limb."
"And then?"
"In the eyes of the state, he's still a counter-revolutionary, Silke," Yelena says, looking down. "There's not much I can do about that."
Silke picks up the medication, tries again to press down the worry, the sadness, and the pain.
Chapter 23.
The White Knights return. Once again, the women revel in spending Sunday evenings walking around the camp, trying to feel for just a couple of hours they have some small amount of freedom. They know where to walk, where it is safe to go, and where to avoid the roaming gangs of men waiting to pounce. The appearance of Josie and Natia makes some of those evenings the happiest, as Natia shows off her ability to walk, her attempts to talk entertain them. They play with her wispy hair, fight over whom she likes the most. The women start to escort Josie and Natia to and from the hut on the warmest nights, so they can spend time all together away from prying eyes and let Natia run about. They take turns putting Natia in their beds, cuddling her as though she is their own daughter. They kiss her and touch her tiny hands and try to teach her their names. Josie lets Natia socialize, giving her a nod and a smile if she looks over for reassurance. Josie sits with Silke on her bed, and Silke has begun to wrap her arms around Josie, press her face against her hair. Josie takes Silke's hand and squeezes it. They communicate in this way, instead of saying what they fear, what they know is coming. The light fades quickly this summer. Several of the women stop venturing out. On one warm night, possibly the final gasp of summer, the women escort Josie to the hut, with Natia snuggled into her arms. Anastasia has become attached to the little girl and reaches for her.
"Would you look after her for a while, please, Nastia?" says Josie, using the affectionate diminutive for Anastasia. "I'd like to talk to Silke."
Silke gets off her bed, reaches for her coat, and follows Josie outside. They don't go too far. There are many people wandering around, and the wind has started up. They find protection beside the hut and huddle against the building.
"Silke, what am I going to do?"
So they are finally voicing this, Silke thinks. Beyond the one brief conversation last summer when Josie had told her one of the other mothers, who'd had several children, said they were sent to orphanages when they turned two, they have never given words to the fear. The mother had been broken, Josie said, completely blank-faced, barely looking at her child. Silke looks away. She has no answer.
"Can you help me, please, Silke? I can't let them take her away. She's my child."
Silke wraps her arms around Josie, letting her sob on her shoulder.
"I can't promise anything, but I'll try. I'll talk to Elena Georgievna. I'll do what I can. I promise."
"Thank you. I know you can help. You've always been able to," Josie says, drawing back from the embrace to look at Silke in such a hopeful, open way that Silke feels ill. Josie still looks so young, a girl.
"Please don't let them take my baby away."
Silke draws her in again, hugs her for a long time.
"Please don't let them take you away."
"Come on," she says. "You need to take Natia back to your hut. The wind has picked up and you don't want her getting sick." Silke speaks to Yelena the next day. Yelena is sympathetic but doesn't think she has any power over the administrators. Both women know there is little chance that they can help Josie and Natia stay together after she turns two, and Josie is forced to return to a general hut without the warm little body to come home to. Josie will die, Silke thinks. She will not survive the heartbreak. Silke has to figure something out.
"Ambulance going out?"
"Coming."
Tossing the file she is holding to Lyuba and grabbing her coat, Silke runs from the ward. Pavel stands holding the passenger door, his big teeth resting over his bottom lip. Seeing her running towards them, he climbs into the cabin. Nothing has changed since their second day together, and so Pavel must sit in the middle.
"Something different today, Silke," Kirill offers.
"Wow, speaking first, Kirill," Silke laughs.
"No, really," Pavel says. "This is serious."
"Aren't they all? Since when did we decide one accident was more serious than another before we even got there?"
"It's not an accident," Pavel says.
We're going to the house of the commandant, Alexei Demyanovich. One of his children is sick and we have to bring him to the hospital.
A child? A boy? How old, do we know?
Well, I don't know if it's a boy, but it's one of the commandant's children.
For the first time since her arrival in Vorkuta, Silke travels on a street outside the compound of the camp and mine. A road built by prisoners. She looks at the houses where families live. Women with small children in tow hurry down the street, carrying bags. They pass several cars. She has seen a car only a few times when someone important visits the camp. A guard waves them down, indicating for them to stop. Piling out, Silke runs ahead with the guard while Pavel and Kirill retrieve the containers from the back. The front door is open and the guard leads Silke into the house and to a bedroom, where a girl tosses and screams on a bed. Her mother sits on the edge of the bed, attempting to put a wet towel on her forehead, speaking in a soothing, comforting voice. Silke recognises her.
"Excuse me, can I take a look at her?" Silke says as she takes her coat off, dropping it onto the floor.
The commandant's wife, Maria, turns around as she stands.
"Hello, you're..."
"Silke Klein, hello again. What has Katya been up to this time?"
"Silke Klein, yes, please, can you help her? She's in so much pain."
Silke moves to the side of the bed, bending down to try to examine the girl who continues to thrash about.
"What can you tell me?" she asks her mother.
"She didn't eat her dinner last night and complained of pain in her stomach. My husband gave her something to settle her."
"Do you know what he gave her?"
"No, I don't know. She didn't come for breakfast. I checked on her and she said the pain was back and wanted to sleep. I left her, but when I returned a short while ago, she was like this and won't say anything. Please, what's wrong with her? You have to help her."
Maria's jewellery clatters on her wrist as she gestures emphatically.
"Let me have a look at her."
Silke attempts to restrain Katya's flailing arms.
"Katya, this is Silke. I'm here to help you," she says soothingly. "Can you please try to lie still and show me where it hurts? There's a good girl. I want to look at your stomach."
Silke glances back at the door, where the guard, Pavel and Kirill, all stand watching.
"You three, get out and shut the door. I'll call you when I want you."
She turns back to Katya and hears the door close.
"That's better. Now, let me see your stomach. You're doing well, Katya. You're a brave girl. I know that. We've met before, when you fell off the roof and broke your arm."
Katya settles somewhat, allowing Silke to lift her nightdress and look at her stomach. She can see it is distended.
"Katya, I'm going to gently touch your stomach. Tell me when I hit the spot that hurts the most."
Starting up beneath her ribcage, Silke gently pushes down, quickly moving her hands a few inches at a time. As she moves down to the lower abdomen, Katya cries out.
"What is it? What's wrong with her?"
Maria fusses. The room carries the deep, rich smell of her perfume, making Silke's nose twitch.
"I'm sorry, I can't be sure, but if we get her into the ambulance and to the hospital, the doctors there will be able to diagnose and treat her. I'm going to give her an injection to help with the pain, and then we will transport her in the ambulance."
Silke can feel how her knees sink into this soft, plush carpet. How nice it would be to lie down in here, to be cared for by a mother, worried over, in this pillow-laden bed.
"I've sent someone to tell my husband. He should be here soon. Maybe we should wait and take her in his car."
"The sooner we get her to the hospital, the better, if you don't mind. I'll ride in the back of the ambulance with her and look after her."
"All right. I trusted you once before, I'll trust you again, and I would like the doctor to be Yelena Georgievna again, too."
"Pavel,"
Silke calls out.
The door opens. Pavel and Kirill stand in the doorway.
"Bring me the medicine."
Kirill hurries over, placing the drug box on the floor and ripping off the lid. Silke quickly locates the medication she wants, fills a syringe and gently injects Katya in the arm. She holds her arm while the pain medication takes effect, and Katya settles.
"Get the stretcher, quick, and take the boxes back with you."
The two return with the stretcher. Silke and Maria lift Katya as the stretcher is placed on the bed. Gently, they lower her onto it, wrapping her up in blankets from her bed.
"Let's go," she says to Pavel and Kirill.
Turning to Maria, she says,
"Do you want to come with us in the ambulance, or can the guard bring you in a car?"
I want to come with you.
You'll need to ride up front. I will be in the back with Katya. The guard hands Maria her coat. Silke grabs hers on the way out of the room as they follow Pavel and Kirill to the ambulance. Silke climbs in the back first and helps Pavel slide the stretcher towards her. Kirill has the engine running, shutting the back doors. Pavel hops into the front. The guard holds the door for Maria and helps her sit next to Pavel. The drive to the hospital is silent, Maria's perfume filling the truck. Word has reached Yelena that the commandant's daughter is en route. She is waiting for them. Following a quick examination, she tells Maria she will need to take Katya to surgery straight away. She is certain she has appendicitis, but won't know for sure until she opens her up. If correct, Katya will be back on her feet within a couple of weeks.
Can I come with you? Maria asks.
Well, no, not really, Maria Danilovna. I'll leave Silke here with you. She can tell you what we're doing.
No, I'll be fine while I wait for my husband. I'd rather she was with you.
Let's go, Silke. Scrub up. To the orderly standing nearby, she says, take the patient to the operating room, please. We'll meet you there. As Yelena walks off, Silke quickly speaks to Maria.
She'll be fine. We will have the two of you back together as quickly as possible.
As Silke walks from the room, she hears the booming voice of the commandant. She takes a moment to watch as he wraps his wife in his arms and she tells him, in a voice thick with emotion, what she knows. Man, woman, child, and the luxury of caring only about one another. Yelena tells Silke she can go and get Maria and the commandant and bring them to Katya, who remains asleep, minus her appendix. Silke stands at the back of the room while Yelena explains what the procedure involved, the recovery period, and offers to stay the night with her. Maria thanks her, asking if it would be possible for Silke instead to stay the night with Katya and her. She's not leaving. The commandant wants his daughter brought home, but agrees she can spend one night in her own room here, away from the prisoners. Chairs are brought into the operating room for Silke and Maria. There'll be no more operations today. Chapter 24. Katya wakes several times during the night. Silke checks on her and administers further injections for the pain, while Maria reassures her daughter that she'll be home soon. After settling Katya once again, Silke sits back down, aware that Maria is staring at her.
Is everything all right? She asks the wife of the commandant who imprisons her.
I don't know how to thank you for your kindness, your care. Watching you with Katya overwhelms me. I don't know why you are here. I don't want to know. But will you let me talk to my husband? Ask him to help you.
Silke doesn't know where to look.
Do you mean that?
Yes. We owe you so much. If it was up to me, you wouldn't spend another night here.
Katya is very special to Alexei Demyanovich. Don't tell anyone, particularly our sons, but I think he does have a favourite child, and it's that young girl lying in the bed.
Silke stands and walks over to Katya, looks down at her, fair and pretty, soon to be moving out of girlhood.
Silke moves a wayward strand of hair from her face.
I've never had a child, Silke says, feeling safe in the warm, quiet room. But I am a daughter. I know the love of a mother and a father.
One day you will, Silke. You are young.
Perhaps.
It is too much to reveal to Maria, this well-fed, cared-for woman, that she doesn't think this will happen for her, ever. If it was possible, surely it would have already happened. She no longer functions inside like other women.
Let me help you leave this place, and it could happen sooner. This is only a temporary post for my husband. We may be back in Moscow soon. This may be your only chance to let me help you.
Silke sits back down, turning her chair slightly to face Maria. Looks her in the face.
Could I use your offer of help for someone else?
Why would you do that? A clearly perplexed Maria asks.
Because there is a mother here, in this camp, who is very dear to me. Her little girl, Natya, will be 2 in a few weeks. As soon as she turns 2, she will be taken away and Josie will never see her again. If there is anything you can do to stop that happening, I wouldn't know how to thank you. I would be so
so grateful. Maria looks away, overcome at hearing this. She looks at her own daughter and holds a hand across her stomach. Surely she knows what goes on, Silke thinks. Maybe she has just never allowed herself to think what it is like for the prisoners, the women. They're suffering. Maria nods her head. She reaches out and takes Silke's hands. Give me her details. Natia and her mother will not be separated if I can help it.
Josefina Kotetska, Silke says.
The door to the room opens. Alexei Demyanovich enters, surrounded by his bodyguards. He looks at the two women. Silke jumps to her feet.
Thank you for looking after my daughter and my wife.
Katya wakes up at the heavy sound of boots on the wooden floor. Seeing her father, she calls out,
Papa! Papa!
Throwing a wink at his wife, Alexei sits on Katya's bed, comforting her. Yelena appears and examines Katya. Everyone in the room is smiling. Silke finds herself in the middle of a happy family occasion and doesn't know how to respond. As Katya is helped into a wheelchair to be wheeled out for the ride home in her father's car, Maria gives Silke a long hug, whispering that she will take care of Natya and her mother. As everyone leaves the room, Silke shuts the door behind them and sits on Katya's bed.
A mother's love, she whispers.
Chapter 25. Yelena meets Silke as she arrives at work. Come with me. Silke follows. Don't take your coat off.
Where are we going? Just come with me.
Yelena walks briskly away from the hospital to the nearby administration building, a three-story stone building standing beside two similar ones. They head round to the back, a more discreet entrance. A guard outside opens it for them without question. They step into a small reception area. Silke quickly takes in her surroundings, looking for threats for anyone who might harm her. She steps forward to be close to Yelena, wanting the security of this woman she has come to trust. And then, there he is. Alexander stands up from behind a desk. She has not seen him up close for so long. He is thin, like all prisoners, but put together, composed. His hair neat, his skin clear, his brown eyes have a warm, open expression. Wait here just one moment, says Yelena to Silke, and she nods to Alexander and walks away down a corridor behind him and through a door.
It'll be all right, Silke, Alexander says quietly, clearly noting her distress and showing he remembers her. He smiles, the corners of his eyes crinkling. Silke's heart pounds.
Josie has mentioned him a few times and she is always grateful to know he is well. Josie also tells her he writes poems on the corners of pieces of paper before tearing them off and destroying them. Silke goes over to the desk. She manages to speak.
I hope so, Alexander, she says.
She looks down and does glimpse scribbles across paper in an expressive hand. She peers back up, cannot help her eyes going to his lips. Silke hears a door close and looks up.
Josie.
Her friend runs towards her, clearly distraught.
Silke, what's happening?
Yelena is following Josie back into the room.
I don't know, Silke says, heart still racing.
Yelena Georgievna, what's going on?
I don't know, just wait a moment, I was told to bring you here.
Maria Danilovna walks into the room, Natya in her arms. Josie cries out and runs to her daughter, stopping herself before she snatches her from the well-dressed stranger's arms. Maria hands Natya over, the little girl clearly happy and calm.
She's a beautiful little girl, Josefina, Maria says.
Come. She beckons them back down the corridor. Silke glances at Alexander, who nods at her and then sits back at his desk. They go into a dull grey room, and Maria closes the door. Maria turns to Silke.
I kept my promise.
What's going on? Josie demands, clutching Natya, terrified. Silke strokes Natya's face, then Josie's.
Josie, this is Maria Danilovna, the wife of Commandant Alexei Demyanovich.
You have nothing to fear. She is helping you.
Helping me how?
Josefina, I offered to help Silke Klein after she saved the life of my daughter not once but twice. Well, it wasn't really me.
I'm telling the story, Silke, Maria says. She saved my daughter's life twice. I asked her what I could do to help her in gratitude for her care. She didn't ask for anything for herself. She told me about you and asked if I could help you and your daughter. I don't understand. You offered to help her and instead you're helping me.
Yes. There is a car waiting outside. It will take you and Nacha to the train station and from there to Moscow. A friend of mine, Stepanida Fabianovna, will meet you in Moscow and take you home with her. I'm hoping you will take up the opportunity of living with her, earning a small allowance by performing duties and helping in her home.
Josie, holding Natya, drops to the floor, sobbing, overcome. Silke bends down beside her, hugging the two of them. Yelena and Maria look on, wiping tears from their own eyes. Natya wriggles free and reaches to put her tiny hands around Silke's neck. Silke sweeps the little girl into her arms, holding her close. She kisses her over and over on the face until the little girl bats her away, causing Josie and Silke to laugh through their tears. Slowly, they all stand up together.
Mama!
Natya squeals as she thrusts her arms towards her mother. Josie takes her. Maria smiles warmly, wiping her eyes.
I'll leave you to say goodbye properly. Give my best wishes to Stepanida Fabianovna. Tell her I will write soon.
As Maria Danilovna opens the door, Silke runs after her, surprising herself by wrapping her arms around her. She catches herself, steps back.
How can I ever thank you?
You already have.
Take care, Silke. I'll be checking on you from time to time.
She gives them all one final nod and leaves. The door opens again. It is a guard.
Time to go. The car's waiting. The train won't.
He holds up a small bag.
The commandant's wife asked me to give you this. It's some clothes for the little one. I'll put it in the car.
They walk back into the reception area. Josie quickly runs over to Alexander.
Goodbye, Alexander, she says.
Good luck, Josie, he says, pressing his hands over hers, over the child. As Josie walks back towards the group, Alexander locks eyes with Silke. She turns away, puts her arm around Josie and Natya, and walks out into the open with them. As they reach the car door, Josie looks from Yelena to Silke.
I don't want to go. I don't want to leave you.
Silke laughs. Josie's words are the most beautiful and absurd she has heard for a long time. She keeps the smile on her face, tries to fight back the tears.
Get in the car. Go. Find your brothers. Have a good life. For me. For all of us. And make sure that little girl does too. I'll think of you. Always. And with nothing but happy thoughts.
One last hug. Natya squeezed between them. The car door is slammed shut. Yelena and Silke watch it disappear, neither wanting to move.
Of all the things I've seen since I've been here, this is what I will remember, what I will cling to when the darkness of this place threatens to envelop me. I don't know how the commandant and his wife have managed it. Someone high up must have owed him a favour. Now back to work. There are other souls to save. Yelena whispers.
The sun breaks through the thick clouds for a moment. Silke feels like she is breaking apart.
Lekel Shalom,
she whispers quietly to Josie.
Go towards peace.
That evening, Silke tells the others of Josie and Natya's departure, making light of her role in their release. Tears are shed, memories relived. Happiness and sadness in equal measure. The conversation opens up, as it often does these days, about their lives before Vorkuta. Their reasons for being there are as varied as their personalities. As well as having been in the Polish Home Army, Elena had been accused of being a spy, and then she speaks to them in English, which has everyone in awe of her.
I knew, of course, says Hannah smugly.
For 5 years they have lived with someone who speaks English. Several ask if she would teach them just a little, a secret act of resistance. Other girls from Poland were also charged with helping the enemy in a variety of ways. None of them mention prostitution. Olga shares again the story of how she found herself on the wrong side of the law for having made garments for a wealthy general's wife. When her husband ran afoul of Stalin and was shot, she was arrested and transported. Margareta begins to sob.
I die a little more each day, not knowing what has happened to my husband.
He was taken with you, wasn't he? Olga asks, as though trying to solve the puzzle aloud.
We were taken together, but sent to different prisons. I never saw him again. I don't know if he is alive, but my heart tells me he is dead.
What did he do? Anastasia asks, having not heard the story yet.
He fell in love with me.
That's it? No, there has to be more.
He's from Prague. He is Czech. I call him my husband, but that is the problem. We dared to attempt to marry. I'm from Moscow, and we are not permitted to marry a foreign citizen.
Silka's heart has been racing throughout this whole conversation. She has been here 5 years, and the women know she is Jewish and Slovakian, but nothing of her arrest. Josie had gathered a bit of information from asking Silka questions, though Silka never elaborated. She had told her about her friends, like Gita and Lale, wondered aloud with Josie about where they were, whether they were safe. She had told Josie about her mother and sister dying, but had not gone into the details. She is ashamed that she had not told her everything. But if Josie had turned away from her, it would have broken her all over again. The hut falls into silent contemplation.
It is time to take my advice again, Olga says to the group. A happy memory. Force it into your head and your heart.
Bardejov, Czechoslovakia, 1939.
Silka, Magda, come here quickly, their mama calls out.
Magda drops the book she is reading and hurries to the kitchen.
Silka, come on, she says.
In a minute, let me finish this chapter, Silka growls back. It's something wonderful. Silka, come on, her mother says.
Oh, all right, I'm coming.
Holding the book open on the page she was reading, Silka stomps into the kitchen. Her mother is sitting at the table, reading a letter. She waves the letter at the two girls.
What does it say? Magda squeals.
Silka stays standing in the doorway, pretending to read, waiting to hear the news.
Put the book down, Silka, her mother says firmly. Come and sit down.
Silka splays the book open on the table as she takes a seat alongside Magda, facing their mother.
What? Silka says.
Aunt Helena is getting married.
Oh, that's wonderful news, Mama, Magda says. I love all your sisters, but especially Aunt Helena. I'm so happy for her.
What's it got to do with us?
Silka asks, nonchalantly.
Well, my two beautiful girls, she wants you to be her bridesmaids. To be part of her wedding, isn't that lovely?
You mean we get to wear a beautiful dress and have flowers in our hair? An excited Magda asks.
Yes, you will both have the most beautiful dresses, and I'm sure Aunt Helena would love you to have flowers in your hair. What do you think, Silka? Do you want to be a bridesmaid? Have everyone looking at you and telling you how beautiful you are?
Silka looks from her mother to her sister, trying to contain the excitement she feels. She fails. Jumping to her feet, knocking over her chair, she swirls around the kitchen, trying to pull her straight dress out.
I'm going to be a princess with flowers in my hair. Can my dress be red? I'd really like a red dress.
That will be up to Aunt Helena, but you can always ask her. She might say yes, but you'll both have to wear the same colour.
I'm going to tell Papa.
Silka rushes from the kitchen, looking for her father.
Papa! Papa! Aunt Helena's getting married! She's in love!
One day, Silka thinks, it will be my turn.
Chapter 26. The winter of 1950-51 is particularly harsh. The hospital is overwhelmed by severe cases of frostbite and other weather-associated ailments. Amputations of lower limbs become common, the survivors immediately shipped off to places unknown to free up the beds. Pneumonia claims many, lungs weakened from constant inhalation of coal dust, no match for the infections that spread through the camp. Cases of pellagra barely make it through the front door. The near corpses are taken with their peeling skin and put on blankets on the floor near the entrance, ready to be taken out to a truck when they expire. Injuries increase alarmingly as frozen fingers lose grip on tools. Crush injuries rise as weakened prisoners are slow to respond to the dangers of heavy equipment and falling rocks. Any suspicion of self-harm is verified when doctors question the injured patients. They beg to be kept in the hospital, or at the very least released from outside work. Some of these self-inflicted injuries are terrible mutilations. Among the worst, Silke has seen. The ambulances struggle to transport the sick and injured, many arriving piled into the back of trucks or carried in by fellow prisoners. With the bleak weather and Josie's departure, combined with the lack of hope, Silke descends into darkness again. She refuses her breaks from going out in the ambulance, picking up, dropping off, and immediately going back out, endlessly caring for the sick, the injured, and dying. She is becoming a stranger on the ward. The mine supervisors praise her bravery in never refusing to go into a dangerous situation. They say her size and competence make her the best person to enter the mine to look for casualties. That word, bravery, again. Silke still thinks she has yet to earn it.
Ambulance going out. Coming.
Kirill, Pavel and Silke race to the mine.
Not asking what we're facing today, Silke, Kirill asks.
Does it matter?
Having a bad day, Kirill fires back.
Drop it, Kirill. Pavel comes to Silke's defence.
All right. It's an explosion, so there'll be burns as well as broken bones, Kirill says.
Neither Pavel nor Silke responds.
Kirill shrugs. If that's the way you're going to play it.
The chaos is evident as they approach the mine. There is the usual gathering of onlooking prisoners moving from foot to foot in an effort to keep warm. Silke is out of the ambulance before the engine is killed.
Silke, over here!
She joins a group of guards. A supervisor appears.
Silke, good to see you. Got a nasty one for you. We were taking explosives into the central drift so we can advance, and one of them went off unexpectedly. We've got at least 6 prisoners in there and about the same number of guards. We've also got our explosives expert in there. He was going to be setting the dynamite. He's the top man around here. Shit, there'll be trouble if he's not all right.
Silke starts walking towards the entrance to the mine.
Pavel, she calls out, bring the box. Come on, hurry up.
The supervisor runs after her.
Silke, you can't go in yet. They haven't declared it safe.
She's heard it all before.
And who's going to declare it safe, standing up here?
With no answer, Silke turns to Pavel.
I can't make you come with me, but I'd like you to. Silke, you heard the man. The walls could collapse around us.
There are men in there. We have to try.
And get killed ourselves? I don't think so.
Fine. I'll go in by myself. Hand me the box. Pavel holds out the box, hesitates, then pulls it back towards himself.
I'm going to regret this, aren't I?
Probably, she says, with a small smile.
Definitely, says the supervisor. Look, I can't stop you, but I can advise against it.
Come, Pavel, let's go.
Here, take the big lamp, the supervisor says.
As Silke and Pavel descend in the lift, the lamp barely penetrates the dust rising and swirling around them. They step out into the darkness and inch forward for several minutes before beginning to call out.
Can anybody hear me?
Silke shouts.
Call out if you hear me so we can find you. Is there anybody here?
Nothing. They walk deeper, getting closer to the blast site, as the ground underfoot becomes an obstacle course, littered with rocks and boulders. The path narrows. Pavel stumbles, slipping on a jagged rock, and screams, as much from the fright of falling as from being hurt.
Are you all right?
His string of expletives bounces off the walls. As the echo dies down, they hear a cry.
Over here! We're over here!
Keep talking, we're coming! Pavel calls out as he and Silka hurry in the direction of the voice. Their combined lights illuminate several men waving and calling to them. As they arrive, Pavel asks who is in charge. A guard sitting beside an unconscious man identifies himself.
Tell me who we have here and what you know of the others, Silka says.
There are six of them. Three guards, two prisoners, and the explosives expert, who is unconscious. Their helmets were knocked off in the explosion, the lights went out at the same time, and they can't see to tell how badly injured they all are. Silka asks if any of them can stand and walk out themselves. Two say they think they can, even though they are badly hurt. One reports he has a broken arm as bone has pierced his shirt and coat. Using the lamp, Silka and Pavel do a quick examination of the men. The explosives expert's breathing is ragged, and he has a head wound. She asks Pavel to check on another unconscious man. It only takes him a moment to report that he is dead. He was one of the guards. Silka concentrates on the explosives expert. Besides the head wound, he seems to have been hit in the chest by something. A depression tells her he has several broken ribs. Silka has the able-bodied men help her lie him straight. She administers a drip into his arm and roughly bandages his head.
What of the others? She asks the guard. We were told there are about 12 of you down here.
The guard tells her to shine her light further ahead. When she does, she sees that the path is mostly blocked by rock from the explosions.
They'll be on the other side of that, he explains. Have you tried calling out to see if any of them respond?
It will be a waste of time. They were about 100 meters in front of us going ahead with the dynamite when it went off. They would have taken the full force of the first explosion, then there were two more. They didn't stand a chance.
All right. I'll let you report that when we get out. For now, let's see who is capable of helping the other men walk out of here. I need at least one to help Pavel carry our expert here.
I can help, the guard says.
I can help,
one of the prisoners croaks, coughing.
Thanks.
Turning to the other prisoner.
Can you keep an eye on him? She says, nodding towards the injured man. He's got a badly broken arm.
I've got him, the prisoner answers. Silka holds the lamp up towards the way out, and the shuffling, wincing men start to follow it. Pavel, behind her, eases his arms under the unconscious man's shoulders, taking a firm grip around his chest. Silka picks up the medication box, places the intravenous bottle of fluid on top, and follows the workers along the long, claustrophobic corridor and eventually into the open door of the lift cage. She looks back. Through the sooty swirl of the lamplight, she can see that Pavel is struggling with the weight of the man. She hears rumbling.
No.
Dislodged rocks break away, spewing out clouds of dust. She hears Pavel scream. Silka hears yelling and the lever of the lift clicking up, the cage door slamming. She coughs and coughs, ears ringing. She collapses, her head hitting the hard caging of the lift wall, her body vibrating as it starts its slow ascent.
Silka? Silka, squeeze my hand.
Yelena's soothing voice drifts into Silka's semi-consciousness.
Hand, feel hand, squeeze. She tells herself.
The small effort of obeying this command sends shockwaves of pain through her body, and she lapses back into unconsciousness. The sound of someone crying out stirs Silka awake. Without opening her eyes, she listens to the familiar sounds of doctors and nurses going about their work, of patients calling out for comfort, calling out in pain. She wants to call out for both.
Are you with us, Silka?
She hears Raisa whispering. She feels Raisa's breath on her cheek. She must be leaning over her.
It's time to wake up. Come on, open your eyes.
Slowly, Silka opens her eyes. The world is a blur.
I can't see, she whispers. You may have blurred vision, so don't panic, Silke. You're going to be all right. Can you see my hand?
Something flashes in front of Silke. A movement. It could be a hand. Silke blinks several times, and each time she does so, her vision clears a little, until she can identify fingers.
Yes, it is a hand. I see it. I see your hand, she mumbles weakly.
Good girl. Now just listen while I tell you how you are. Then you can tell me how you feel, all right?
Yes.
You have had a nasty blow to the back of the head requiring 20 stitches. I can't believe you made it out of there when the whole tunnel was collapsing. What are you made of?
Stronger stuff than you thought.
We had to cut some of your hair away, I'm afraid, but it will grow back. Now, you're bound to have a headache and we don't want you talking, feeling like you have to do anything.
Silke opens her mouth to speak. Pavel.
She's remembering the last moments in the mine. She gurgles his name, in distress.
It's all right, Silke, Raisa says.
Pavel.
I'm sorry, Silke. He didn't make it.
And it is my fault, she thinks. I made him go in. She closes her eyes.
I am cursed. Everyone around me dies or is taken away. It is not safe to be near me.
Silke, you have grazes and bruises on your upper back where the rock landed. You must have been bent over when it happened. They are nothing serious and are healing nicely. She tries to breathe. It doesn't matter about her.
How are the other men?
Oh, Silke, only you would ask about others before yourself. Thanks to you, the workers who came out before you are mostly fine. Silke is relieved they're not all dead. But Pavel, she should have been more careful. Now, Raisa says, here is how you're going to be treated, and I want your promise that you will do as we tell you. I want none of your interfering, even if you do think you know more than all of us put together.
Silke says nothing.
I said promise.
I promise,
she mumbles.
Promise what?
To do as I'm told, not to interfere and think I can heal myself.
I heard that, Yelena says, having snuck up on them. How is our patient?
I'll do the talking. You've just agreed to keep quiet, Raisa says.
I said nothing about keeping quiet.
My question has just been answered. Silke, tell me how you feel. Where does it hurt?
It doesn't.
Yelena huffs. I want you to stay lying flat for another 24 hours. Try not to move too much. Let your body heal, particularly your head. I suspect you've been badly concussed, and only rest will heal that.
Thank you,
Silke manages. Get some rest. I got word back to your hut that you were injured but are going to be all right. I know how close you are to the women there, and I thought they might be worried.
Hannah certainly will be, she thinks. But the last container Silke got for her will last for a while.
Silke's thoughts turn back to Pavel, and a tear escapes and runs down her cheek. The next day, Silke opens her eyes to find a strange man leaning over her. Before she can say anything, he grabs one of her hands and kisses it.
Thank you for saving my life. You are an angel. I've been watching you sleep, hoping you would wake up so I could thank you.
She recognizes him as the explosives expert from the mine. Liuba appears beside him.
Come on, back to your own bed. I've told you, you can't keep coming over here. Silke needs her rest.
But, Liuba, it's all right. Let him stay for a moment, Silke croaks.
Thank you again.
How are you? You didn't look too good last time I saw you, Silke says.
So I've been told, but I'm much better. I'm going back to my hut tomorrow, so I must be.
Silke manages a smile.
It's been good to see you. Look after yourself.
As the man goes back to his bed, Liuba reappears in front of Silke.
I hear your quick actions and direction saved him and the other workers. He won't stop going on about it.
But Liuba, I dragged Pavel in and now he is dead. You needed help, and it was his choice. He came in because he cared about me, I see it now.
Well, then he'd be glad you made it out.
Can I see her?
Kirill appears behind Lyuba, who steps aside.
How are you feeling?
He asks, with genuine concern.
I'm so sorry, Kirill. I'm so sorry, Silka says, close to tears.
It wasn't your fault what happened to Pavel.
But he only helped because I asked.
He would help you even if you didn't ask. I guess you'll have to ask me now.
I don't think I want to do this anymore. Go out with you, without Pavel.
Don't say that. Of course you'll be back. You just have to get better.
Silka sighs.
I don't think I can be the one who risks others' lives.
Silka Klein, mostly you don't tell others what to do. They risk their lives because you don't ask. That's why they want to help you. Don't you understand that?
Silka looks at Kirill, seeing him differently. The bravado he has shown her, even the contempt he has shown towards her, has gone. He briefly touches her hand with his big, hairy one.
Get better. I'll come and check on you in a couple of days. And Silka, Pavel wasn't the only one who cared about you.
Before Silka can respond, Kirill walks away. Silka doesn't keep her promise. Over the next 10 days, as she recovers, she is growled at, yelled at, threatened with being tied down. She is most active at night, when staff numbers are low. Several times she attempts resuscitation on patients she hears having trouble breathing. Mostly she just visits other patients and comforts them. Her injuries heal, her headaches reduce, and the stitches are removed from her scalp. She hides the continued pain in her back, not wanting to prolong her stay on the ward, and asks Yelena to release her so she can go back to the hut. She shouldn't be taking up one of these precious beds.
You can go soon, Yelena tells her.
A few days later, as Silka and the medical team emerge from surgery, Silka's first since she has been back on her feet, the camp long since closed for the night, they are met by several senior camp officers. The officers inquire about the explosives expert and are relieved to hear he is doing well and will, after a few more days of care, be able to resume his duties. Silka tries to slink away from the conversation, moving to the back of the group. As she tries to leave the room, one of the men calls out,
"Nurse, please stay where you are."
Silka freezes. She doesn't know what she has done wrong, but no good has ever come from being spoken to directly by a camp commandant. When the doctor has finished his report, the commandant walks over to Silka. Tall, slim, the cap on his head resting off to the side, he resembles someone she once knew. Someone who used her. She starts to shake as memories she fights hard to bury flood back. "Are you the nurse who went into the mine and saved the injured men?" Silka can't answer. He repeats the question.
"Yes," she stammers. "I went in, but it was the doctors who saved the patients."
"That's not what I heard. Your bravery saved many men, and I want you to know we are grateful."
"Thank you, I was just doing my job."
"What's your name?"
"Silka Klein, sir."
"Are you a registered nurse here?"
Before Silka can answer, Yelena butts in.
"Silka has been trained here by many senior doctors and other experienced nurses. Her skills are exceptional, and we're very grateful to have her."
The commandant acknowledges the comments.
"Nevertheless, you are a prisoner here."
"Yes," Silka murmurs, her head lowered.
"Do you live in the nurses' quarters?"
"I live in hut 29.
The commandant turns to the doctor.
"She may move into the nurses' quarters."
With that, he leaves, his entourage trailing behind him. Silka slides down the wall that had been holding her up, trembling. Yelena helps her to her feet.
"You must be exhausted. It's been quite a time for you. Let's find a bed here for you to sleep in for one more night. I don't want you going back to your hut tonight, and tomorrow we'll talk about moving you."
Silka allows herself to be led away.